welcoming you to Talking Earth. This is Barbara Lamorticella. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. And this is the time and this is the night to experience the voices of poets from Portland, from Oregon, and from around the country directly from this air room into your ear. And I'm very, very happy to be able to present two very fine poets tonight. Penelope Scambly-Schott is with me in the studio. Welcome, Penelope.
Thank you.
And also Judith Montgomery. Hi, Judith.
All the way from Bend.
All the way from Bend. And both Judith and Penelope have worked together over the years, and they have very different voices and are very appreciative of each other's words and techniques. And they got together tonight before the program and wove together a reading for us, reading back and forth to each other. They both have new books out, and Judith, her book is called Red Jess. And she's going to tell us, in fact, both Judith and Penelope are going to tell us about the meanings and how they chose the titles of their books. Judith, this is your second collection, Red Jess, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, it is.
And your first collection won the Oregon Book Award in 2000. Very impressive.
Much to my surprise.
And congratulations, because it isn't very often that a first book wins an award like this. Judith lived in Portland for many, many years, so she's well known to many people in the Portland area. And she moved to Bend in 2001 and is a poet in residence at Central Oregon Community College and getting ready to retire. And I know that that retirement is going to be a full plunge into writing. And you have been working with Penelope for a long time, and in fact Penelope and the group that you work with means so much to you that you regularly drive from Bend.
Thanks to my Subaru, and I have to say studded snow tires in the winter.
Penelope has only been and immediately fell in with a fabulous band of other women poets, I have to say. She's working with Judith, with Karen Braucher, with Willa Schneeberg, with Paul Ann Peterson. And just 5 years ago, she's been in Oregon only 5 years, and she has written two books in that time, and two books earlier. The newest one and the one that she'll be reading from tonight is called Baiting the Void. So I want to welcome you. I've already talked a lot, and you have worked out a wonderful reading between you. So I'm going to be quiet now. But I wanted to ask you to begin with, if you want to say something about how you made the title of the book.
Well, Judith asked. This is Penelope, and Judith asked me this afternoon as we were alternating playing with my dog and making lists of poems to read. She said, "What does your title mean? Baiting the Void." And I said, "Well, it was something about emptiness and trying to make sense out of absences and kind of the thing that all poets are doing, which is trying to use words to solve all the mysteries of life." And we then had a discussion about bait. And did it mean to bait as in bear baiting? Did it mean to put cheese in a mousetrap? what did it mean? And I kind of thought that it was both challenging and filling, that spiritual void that people run into in their lives. But I don't really know what it means. I know that I took it from as a last line from the poem that I'm going to start with. The poem is called The Snows of Yesteryear. It's a famous line from a French poem, "Where are the snows of yesteryear, les neiges d'antan?" And the poem goes like this. "Where are the mice of yesteryear? Humus under leaf shred. Where are the mice of yesterday? Bone chips in the pellets of owls. Where are the mice of an hour ago? In the clean mouth of the cat. Where is the mouse of now? In the dim kingdom behind the wall. After the framer, electrician, painter locked the door, scoots the mouse on her delicate pink feet, that thief who stows away below the decks of expectation, and will shorten our voyage from buoy to buoy. What courage it takes us to make anything of nothing, when only this nothing clangs with importance, while inside our walls, mouse is mincing the new insulation into a loose nest for a handful of hairless pinkies, waiting to smell of cellar and shed, ready to bait the void." We're always dealing with voids in our lives and the people we lose. I've discovered about the important deaths that have occurred among people that I've loved is there are two terrible things. One is when they die, and even worse is when they stay dead. So this poem is called My Father's Employment. "Such a demanding job. Another ordinary Wednesday and you're still dead. This weekend you'll be dead too. Don't you ever get a day off? I am shaking the dry coins of the Chinese money plant. Look, you can see through each disc into the bright kingdom of precious objects that don't exist. I would spend every leaf in my garden to cover your wages for half an hour. So you might knock off and sit with me here in the striped shade of stripped branches, and we might sip our tea in tall glasses of air. Suppose I go put the kettle on. A painted chair waits under the big maple. Now I am pouring the water over your ashes. Let us drink tea together after they steep." And of course, we always worry about the people that we love and how fragile our lives are. I have a beautiful daughter who's always been beautiful. But nobody stays young forever. She's in her 30s now, and this poem is called My Daughter Who Was Once 11. It refers to the poet Sappho and her daughter Clace. "No," said Sappho, "you adore her flesh too much. Be this your punishment. She must get old. A long black coyote skulks through my unplowed pasture. Each night, the 10 pearl moons of her fingernails orbited my heart. The black coyote has not yipped yet, but he approaches. The white sheep know nothing about him. Now I race back to Sappho and ask, where is your Clace in yellow ribbons? The moon sinks. She got old, says Sappho, and wrinkled. Her velvet cheeks sank over her teeth. Coyote sneaks closer. Lady, you offer me no sweet answers. No, says Sappho, but I don't lie." So that's the void that I've been trying to bait. And let's hear about the title of Judy Montgomery's book.
Well, Red Jess is not the name of a redheaded woman, which I've been asked often. I'm very interested in issues of confinement and escape, being fenced in, getting away from things. And the Jesses are the ties that hold the falcon down to the falconer's wrist. It's usually used in the plural, which is probably why my title sounds a little ambiguous or perplexing. But I'm just very interested in that whole notion of something being held down and then possibly escaping or being released. And the first poem in the book refers to Red Jesses, so I thought it might be good to start with that one. It's called Aperture, and for those of you who are photographers, and I am not a photographer but an admirer of photographs, it refers to the opening of the lens as well as other possible openings. So this poem is Aperture. When the falconer unhoods the hawk, looses her red jesses, I uncap the lens to scope the sight, frame, shadow, light, but some other hand selects the one fit shot, the stranger rising through my spine. She strikes the neuron flint, sparks lightning branch to branch, and so flashes me, and so the box, and so that shot. Then decamps, leaving me to stow the Nikon, strike a smoke, wait out the burn. Tonight I shot myself, turned the camera's eye coldly in, clicked, brushed shaking to the dark room, silver stink of chemical. Suspended in the red, I dip and lift, looking for the latency so I can know her bones. And for those of you who are writers, artists, or poets, you may recognize the dark side of the muse in that poem. I'd also like to read, I noticed that Barbara sent out on her email part of a long poem, and I promise not to read the whole thing, called A Cultural History of Fences. I'll just read the first section, which is what she sent out on her email. But it deals with the kinds of fences that tend to be built around women or that we build for ourselves and the consequences for us. So this is part one of A Cultural History of Fences. Here's how I met my second husband. Told him exclosure was no word, tapping his report with my red pen's point. Enclosure, I said, was what he must have meant. A fence erected to keep something close, to keep the thing from getting too far, too wild away. He ran a finger down the spines of heavy, worn books, underscored triumphantly the glossary of botany. Exclosure, a space fenced against intruder, sheltering some valued shrubs or herbs so they might blossom safe within, keeping every demon on the out. Later, at coffee, elbows propped noticeably close, hands holding mugs stained like purple plums to hide our mouths, we were sheltered by vermilion-edged spokes of Dracaena marginata, keeping colleagues from approaching, knees not touching, yet. I'm going to read one more poem that was in the Oregonian yesterday, courtesy of the Poetry Quarter and the poetry editor, called Swift. The original title for my book was Flight, because I discovered there were a number of poems that seemed to have birds in them. And although this may appear not to deal with escape and enclosure, to me, it speaks most strongly of the bonds between parents and their children. Swift. The boy's eyes glitter from the roof above. His long shadow spills down the brick drop and pools on concrete where his father, shaking in thin sun that strikes the schoolyard clock, takes two groaning steps and stops and pleads, calling his fled child back from the brink where love and gravity contend for thrall. The gutter shudders underneath that weight, but for this moment holds the unfledged boy at tip point of flight, as though he could poise a high-wire artist lifted in bright lights before riding the trapeze, arced above the crowded dark, the unforgiving ring, the safe hold of the net. There is no net. A swift dart through the vacant space that draws this wingless boy to press intent against the gravest verge, He steps beyond recall. His father runs to try to break his fall. Mm. And I'm going to turn the mic more or less back over to Penelope. We thought we would move into some poems with a little bit more edge to them, just for your interest. So, Penelope?
The poem that I want to read now is, I guess, an anti-war poem. It's certainly about what war, even without combat, can do to somebody. My husband was drafted long before I knew him. And this poem is called Welcome Home, Soldier. I wrote it on Veterans Day a few years ago. And I found that I had a kind of bitterness in me that surprised me. Thank you, America, for sending him home. Thank you for drafting him mid-semester, for rushing his first girlfriend into his wife, into his ex-wife. Thank you, America, for teaching him loneliness in this man's army and everywhere he goes. Thanks, Uncle Sam, for selecting a shy boy and shoving him into a scared space so his eyes are neither blue nor gray, even as his hair grays over the smooth forehead of that boy I never knew. Thanks to the officers of Provision and Supply who fitted him for war. Personal thanks for his bald, middle-aged legs here in my bed, calves rubbed hairless up to the tops of his combat boots. Thanks for assigning him to Signal Corps. Whenever he wants to kill, he remembers he never learned how and is still guilty for being grateful. Thanks for that, too. Thank you for teaching him to be too careful, to imagine every worst thing. Thanks for a whole life of hesitations. Thank you, America, for his nightly crouch in the electronic foxhole of his study, where every signal is virtual, www.vietnam, and no one got hurt. But the ones in the wall and in hospitals and shelters and alleys and jails all over the land of the free, where we still keep pretending, God bless America, my husband is perfectly well. It, in his late 50s, he's probably starting to recover. Mm-hmm. But it's a frightening thing.
What do you mean that's kind of an anti-war poem? Maybe it's an anti-war poem.
Well, I have more to say on the subject, but I'll spare you tonight. There's a lot of damage in the world. This next poem is about a woman that I've completely invented, but I think she may represent a lot of women who carry anger. This is called Washing Moon. Under her serge dress, those are her briny ankles. Every full moon she washes her knives in the sea to keep them sharp. She hones each blade on the sandy sole of her foot. With a hot mouthful of straight pins, she is pinning a lace collar of tatting and open work to the full slope of her bodice. It swells and falls like foam on water. Before her, sea rack and one lost fork whoosh and retreat with the casual pebbles. Tonight, in a blue town, she will dine with that fork, its barnacles and tines, salty as blood, and beside her at table, in the place of a husband, these long-handled knives.
not a dinner I'd want to go to. The next two poems are part of this arrangement we worked out, but also happen to be on Barbara's sort of top hits list. So I'm really happy to be reading these next, and in particular to thank Barbara for having us here together. Penelope and I are really enjoying the going back and forth of our voices. This next one is called Drought, and from a poetry point of view has an interesting history. It began with a fabulous line that I had in my head, and I wrote the whole poem, and then when I took it to my friends, they said, oh, it's great, we love it, but that line has to go. And so the line is gone. They said, oh, you can use it in another poem, which I know I never will. This poem is called Drought.
Aren't you going to tell us the line?
Yes, we must hear. First, read
I'll
poem,
read the poem, and
then
I'll tell
us the line. We must.
And then, well, we have virtual voting. Everyone can vote on whether the line should go back in or not.
We must recognize and thank the line.
Okay. So here's the poem without the line. Drought. They agreed to lie apart, heat split in bed, salt mortar hardening between them on the sheets. Grateful. They were grateful for excuse, no conduit of speech, no pressing flesh. All week the heat set, gluing words to walls, incinerating sills. At midnight his cigarette burned its heart behind the kitchen screen. Her face cracked in silver ash, a flickering in attic panes. Dog moon scorched the tender sky, thunder rattled tin. Then lightning caught, and without warning drought broke. The mountain shook loose ropes of roily clouds. White curtains snapped at glass, gutters overspilled. They fled the house, flinching under rain chill. A godsend, the neighbor called from the fence, the downpour. What could they do but nod, rooted separate and wet on the slumping porch? Okay, so the missing line, I hope people aren't laughing out here, but the missing line that had started the poem was, the green inexorable blessing of the rain. And it's gone.
So
forever.
You went from that to drought.
Yes. I had
they
to figure
really
out
beat
why.
That line up. They
I had to
beat
figure
that
out
line black and blue.
Why, where inexorable came from.
Whoa.
And that's where I ended up with drought. So.
Wow.
Well, that's how you ended up with a sloping porch.
Yeah, I guess. All that rain. Which it's been doing over in Bend, by the way. We've been complaining that it's just like over in Portland, it's raining so much.
Yes, but when you got here today, you kept saying how green it is here.
Yes, true. There are trade-offs for everything. The next poem I'm going to read is called Quick Creek. There have been a number of mine disasters in the last 6 months, many of which have ended up with fatalities and suffering on the part of those in the mines and those who wait above. And somehow that, I used to rock climb when I was in college, but I was never a caver. And the idea of going underground I find quite terrifying in the dark with all that rock above you. And so the Quick Creek disaster of a few years ago, in which 9 men were buried underground for 3 days before they were rescued successfully, just kept coming back in my mind. So this is the poem. Do not dwell on the waters bursting from the sunk lake, or the cramped cave presenting a finger hold of ledge, or the wreckage, drill, lamp, shuttle, cart, the blocked exit, the mine's cold silence that weighs on their heads. Not on light extinguished in the sprung torrid's roar, or the inches of air each is spared, nor the farewell notes tucked in the bucket, the 3 days listening for someone to roll the rock away. Unger, Mayhew, Pugh, Hillman, Hall, Philippi, Stewart, Foy, each greeted at the 77th hour by the archangelic basket, let down the slow drilled shaft to lift them in turn to heaven, earth, surface. No, let us dwell in the earth with the ninth, Popernak, who elects to be last, to be left, to be alive and holding in a coal crypt his faith that the golden basket will not stutter, will descend again for him, will pluck him from the cave where he waits unaccompanied by blood, kin, or touch of a single human hand. Friend, now do you feel the least seep of water at your ankle? Can you hear the ratchet of the rescue basket's long-measured rise out of sight? Sealed away from sky, caught deep in cleft rock, can you fathom, friend, his 15 eternal minutes holding fast against the angel absent dark?
That gives me chills every time.
Wonderful.
Yeah. It's funny because I'm first just listening to a poem about people stuck in a mine. And then when you get to the last man, I'm in the mine.
It's a scary place to be. To be down there and to be last and to choose to be. You know, I think it would be, relatively speaking, easier to choose who gets rescued first, the person who is most elderly or has heart symptoms or is most injured. But how do you choose to be last, not knowing for sure that the basket will come back to get you? That is just an amazing act to do.
And what you have just been listening to is the voice of Judith Montgomery reading from her new book, Red Jess. This is Barbara Lamorticella. This is KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. The time is 10:30. And with me in the studio also is Penelope Scambly-Schott, both reading from their newest books. And Penelope's is called Baiting the Void. And Penelope is going to start the next set. And what is that, Penelope?
Well, we decided, as Judy and I worked this out over a bottle of wine she brought all the way from Bend, we decided that after having had war and mine disasters, it was time for some love. So this is called The Generosity of Pears. The generosity of pears, the small gravel of the brown bosque, gritty between the teeth, and a yellow bartlet ripened too long in a blue bowl, its velvet flesh gone milky and wet, like custard before bed, juice drawing flies, plus one decorous Anjou, minding its pale green manners in a cool metal lunchbox. Remember how we knelt in the orchard between arched rows, how we pointed our wooden ladders into the rooms of the sky, how we crated up beauty side by side in its own perfume. As the rim sun touches noon, and three grown men in worn jeans, gone white at knee and crotch, straddle the stacked lumber, unbuckle their heavy leather carpenter's belts, and reach into the truck for the packed lunch. Remember the wet tip of the tongue, flicking the bow of the top lip, the full curve of the lower lip that slips over slick flesh, the sweet swelling and melt in the space between our bones. You, I have loved completely. Your beauty like three pears, smooth in the hasp of calloused palms. Each man, unshaven and fragrant as the white blossoms of April, each bud concealing its jewel.
Probably should distribute fans to cool ourselves off when you read that poem.
Well, instead, we're going to move on to an orchard with you.
Well, that's true. We thought these would make good pairs. And just for fun, I thought I would do a poem in form. This is a pantoum, which you will find has lots of repetition in it. I just won't go beyond, but the lines repeat and revolve all through the poem and then return back to the beginning. And there's rhyming and all sorts of other wonderful effects, and it's quite a challenge to write, but quite a lot of fun. This is called Blaze with Apples. Frostlight falls like a blessing on the sheets that twine our bodies close in harvest dreams. The blankets tossed as thighs and mouths repeat the coupling and uncoupling, peach and cream. Our bodies twine as intimate as dreams of ripening gold apricot and pear. The coupling and uncoupling, peach and cream, the dip and swell of flesh still August bare. Frost seals September's ripening this pair of lovers grafted root and bud and stalk in one joint dip and swell that autumn bears as orchards blaze with apples before dark. Two lovers grafted late, late budded stalk, one shimmer under moon that rhymes each leaf and silvers apples blazing through fall dark and lights the bed that heals our separate griefs. Come, shimmer under moon that primes each leaf, fall blankets tossed as mouths and thighs repeat the graft that heals us of our separate grief, the frostlight like a blessing on our sheets.
It's lovely. After all that hot fruit, I think we should cool off. And this is a poem that Barbara specifically asked me to read. It's called The Nature of Clouds. And there's not, I have to tell you, although you may all be poetry fans, this is not metaphoric. This is about a real cloud. I live up above skyline, and sometimes when it's just cloudy other places, the cloud is actually on my house. So here goes. The Nature of Clouds. There is a cloud on my house. The cloud has arrived in strings and wisps and ringlets. The cloud has wrapped my house away from the valley. When I step outside my house, the cloud is on me. I stand outside my house in a place like rain. The rain moves neither up nor down, just very delicately toward the east. What color is the cloud? Pink and opalescent gray. Maybe if I were outside the cloud, it would be black. What does the cloud taste like? Rhododendron. Pink star rhododendron lifting spiky petals into the gray. What does the cloud think? Hill. The cloud thinks about leaving this hill. The cloud misses the Western Ocean. Nobody has told the cloud that when it comes to the snowy mountains, it will break. The cloud doesn't fully know the nature of clouds. When I open my front door, pieces of cloud waft into the house. The pieces float among sofas and chairs. Now the cloud is stuck inside my house, and I am sad for the cloud. Therefore, I open the back door to let it move on. The rest of the cloud streams through my house. It touches papers with its moist breathing. It swipes against walls and makes them shine. My old dog lifts her head. She watches the cloud go out the door. Then she puts her muzzle down on her crossed paws and thinks the thoughts of a cloud. Neither the dog nor the cloud will say what they are thinking. Maybe they are lucky and think only in wisps. A wisp is coming to me now. I am 10 years old on the summer lawn, and my father, who is still blonde and gawky, is doing a somersault on the sweet grass. He has huge black shoes. My father has gone to where the cloud is going, all broken into molecules, and where my old dog will go soon. When I am dying, I will try to remember the day there was a cloud in my house. I will wait like that cloud for someone to open a door. And I have another little tiny poem about my father. He died about 6 years ago. And he was the man who taught me to love words. We were raised on bad puns. This is called First Spring. Wind, do you know me? April without my father, my hair has blown white. Beneath the plank bridge, pale petals of the pear tree float over slick stones like thin white lockets, one untranslatable word inside each petal. And now Judy Montgomery is going to read something about her father.
I am. I am fortunate enough to have both my mom and dad still with me. My dad has atrial fibrillation, where the heart, the electrical impulses in the heart don't work properly. And so one of the solutions or treatments for that is to have a cardioversion. So, of course, I went to the dictionary. And cardio, of course, is the heart part. And version is like verse, which means the turning. So it means to turn the heart over, at least in poetry terms. I'm not sure. There's probably a surgeon out there who's wincing as I say this. But it's just like all those medical programs you see on TV where they get the paddles up and they shock the heart. And the theory is that it will shock it back into its proper electrical rhythm. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. This is called cardioversion. Because your heart flutters its leaves as you would riff beneath your thumb the pages of a book that slips at sunset from your grasp and stops in shade beneath the garden bench, they pencil you in for emendation. Doctors will read from the ink dark screen hung above the ribbon of your bed a fluid green calligraphy that diagrams the leap and falter of your truant signature, the blood pause that would bud its scarlet fist and not a black bouquet in your brain. Surgeons will synchronize the charged advance of plus and minus paddles to your chest, will summon to order your body's giddy scatter, will override, accelerate, and linger, will attempt to reprove your fibrillating heart, that white-paged butterfly, beating and pausing at the hinge of dusk to watch the last petal shut.
Yes. Well, I'm glad it worked and your father is still with you. I think when I was trying to bait that void, that I was talking about longing. And there's a kind of longing that I always associate with being a child. You don't even know what it is you want, but you know there's more, whatever it is. And then, of course, you grow up and you find out what it is, and sometimes you're glad and sometimes you're not. But anyway, this is called The Green Longings of Upstairs Windows. And if you can think back, There's a feeling that you may have had as a child in the summer. Remember, it stayed so light so late this time of year, and you don't have school, and if you lived in the East, there were fireflies. And there's something out there, but you don't know what it is. So here goes. The Green Longings of Upstairs Windows. These are the signs. Slam of a screen door, spiky cucumber warm from the vine, sadness of cherry pits spat into grass, illumination of the fireflies. At open windows, behind white curtains, the children are not sleepy. Mommy, I'm not sleepy. I'm not. How stern the tutelage of fall. Purple eyelash of the fringed aster. Garter snake in yellow poison ivy. What you don't learn comes round again until you do. But you can be kept back until you're too big for the chairs. And of course, things coming round again leads me to another poem, which is called Inchworm, Inchworm. "You're dead a long time," said my uncle, tipping port from the garnet decanter. The same old uncle who flicked his fat finger under the strap of my AA bra decades ago when I turned 12. Same uncle, a long time dead. Who knows where the soul goes, in the hard earth or the soft? A little green inchworm is measuring the weathered edge of a picnic table, where a tin milk can fills up with rain. We are growing a new crop of uncles, weeding and hoeing. A young girl runs through the drizzle, ducking under the hedges. We shout for her without opening our mouths. Replenishment is her name. And yes, she is lovely beyond any measure. When my mother read this poem, she knew which uncle I meant, because he had done that to her as well. And since she was raised in a very Victorian family, and I spent lots of summers with my grandparents, and therefore I'm a little late along to have had a Victorian childhood, but I did. We remember Uncle Abe. And, of course, at the time I was pretty grossed out, but hey, the old man had energy. So, anyway, I talked earlier about spitting cherry pits out onto to the grass. We got in big trouble for that. Anyhow, cherries and April and the whole thing, just, I think as the fruits come back this year, it's the same kind of replenishment. You've lived through this before, but you never know what's happening. So I have one poem that I definitely want to read, and then we're going to hear a couple of poems by Judy, and we'll talk a bit and maybe read a little more, but this is my official last poem, okay? It's called April Again. The most brutal movie I ever saw was time-lapse film of fruit in a dish. All that tender ripeness caving in on itself. The collapse of is into was. When I glimpse my face in a mirror, I remember a chipped colander mounded with yellow cherries, some rotting and some just dried. Remarkable, all remarkable, like this loose pebble in my palm. Its sparkle of mica, speck of lichen, thinking of nothing but cling, cling. My fists are clusters of blossoms, and inside them, the stone knuckles, with whatever of flesh will adhere, adhering. Yes, I am old enough to discuss April with a certain earned authority. How pale petals on the cherry tree guess nothing about the hard pit. Let's move on to Judy's official final poem.
Judith, could I ask, there's a poem I would like to hear you read.
Okay, Dealer's Choice.
Composition with Machete. It's long, but I think because the poem that Penelope just read was about a film of decomposition. I think this is a wonderful poem, Composition with Machete, and it is a frozen moment. It's a very strong poem. I thought we wouldn't have time for it, but I think we will.
Okay.
So maybe we could put
of slide it right in here. I mentioned earlier, well, the first poem I read was called Aperture, and I'm very interested in photography. In part because I'm interested in the moral stance that the photographer takes. Do you take your picture, or do you, in a scene of violence, enter it and try to help out the people who are the victims in that case. And therefore, also by extension, when someone later looks at the photograph, is there an issue of complicity as mm-hmm. well? So this is called Composition with Machete. It's a series of five sort of sequential looks at a photograph taken by Anastasia Vroknos in Jakarta, Indonesia. One, two figures burst the papered streets apart, dead run right to left in flight, pursuit. Against the scarred tree and the background of barred fence, the machete gleams in perfect diagonal axis at the center of the shot. Two, the young man at right could be a dancer slung by Tharp, his left leg gracefully supporting his lunge. His white shirt twists, shadow to torso, his mouth a grimace, his left arm flung back like a matador's to offset the slash of the right scarlet cape. There is no cape. His machete strikes a perfect diagonal, splitting the center of the shot. Three, the young man at left, who could be named his cousin, his schoolmate, his neighbor, is catapult in flight, his right leg supporting the torso's helpless shudder away from the blade. His elbows convulse to shelter lung and belly. The machete sweeps a perfect diagonal, cleaving the center of the shot. Four. If we could imagine a light, ripe studio, the boy models breaking their pose for a smoke, we could purely applaud the deft composition, how the hunter's left shin parallels the blade, how the parting billow of the prey's shirt untucking seems already to yield his body to the knife. We would admire the impeccable diagonal blazing through the center of the shot. Five, there is no studio, pose, break. Like the watchers in the picture, the man leaning easy against the metal ledge, the woman in the loose blouse safe behind the fence, we enter the photograph as fulcrum to the blade that levers the blood weight of their hearts, as witness, without stopping the lens or the juggernaut, to documentation of the next watched revenge. Well, that sort of stops everyone dead in their tracks, doesn't it?
It is so vivid. It is just so... I just... His left arm flung back like a matador's to offset the slash of the right's scarlet cape. There is no cape. His machete strikes a perfect diagonal. It's... You really captured that.
When I was in college, I took quite a number of art classes, and so absorbed some things about composition. And so when I look at a wonderfully, artfully done photograph, you can't help but observe how it's been framed, how it's been photographed. And yet at the same time, it's a photograph of this terrible thing happening. So there's the beauty and the terror all occurring at once in the photograph, mm-hmm. which I find fascinating.
And it could be his cousin, his schoolmate, his neighbor. Oh, my God, this is Composition with Machete.
When I first read Red Jess, I thought that Judy was for sure a photographer.
And once you see my photographs, you'll know that I'm not. But thank you for the compliment.
We have about 4-5 more minutes.
Is that the one you wanted to end with?
Anger, Iron, Origami, or Wick?
Well, I think Wick is the one you wanted to end with, yes?
Okay, so. Why don't I do that one then? This was a trick assignment by Doug Marks in his class, in case you're listening, Doug. He said, we should go home, pick our favorite piece of music, and write the poem that was the equivalent of that. So we all went home and worked dreadfully hard, and we came back, and he said, ha, I can't do it, can you? They are not equivalent. Not deterred, however, I kept working on the poem and ended up with what is the last poem in the book. Wick. We keep watch at dock edge, dusk unfurling at our feet, waiting for glints to prick the mountain's indigo slope. Waterfalls shimmer under moon's white invitation. A pebble rolls the children from the cabin down the shore, shadows slipping path to bank, one inlet to our left. A last snap, and we are all in place, each lake family at its point, waiting for the moon to lift free of clinging pines. Above, the stars replenish their sweep, let loose one shot of fire, perfect streak extinguished in the black. Wish. Then a shining thread picked from hill's rough wool. Moon pulls her bright warp through night branches, shadow weft. Loon echoes close, peepers speed their starry shout, and moon slides up the silver note, candling in lake and sky. It's time. We strike our matches, light the wicks of candles waxed upright on our palm-sized boats. Kneeling, nudge the craft out to float on light-combed waters. Four boats from our point, three across the way, two rocking in the music of a brook. The candle boats hesitate, then radiate from shore, their pulse conducting ours toward the center of the lake. We cannot look away, having launched something like ourselves into the dark. Dipping in mirror ink, the boats stroke on a silk that shivers moon and mountain, the name of every light that flickers and is gone.
Thank you, Judith. Did you want to end with that? I think that would follow beautifully.
Well, I'm just thinking about the fact that it's really after my bedtime, and your show is so late, because, of course, I'm one of these wimps who goes to bed early, and I'm looking forward to going home and crawling into bed. But I also was thinking about my husband who'll be waiting there. And this poem is called Telling My Husband Why I Do It. And what the it was is, for about 5 years, I worked as a home health aide taking care of elderly sick people. And since I'm also a college professor, people couldn't understand why I was doing that. So this is why I do it. Why I tend the elderly, really for practice. How I made the widow's bed, two bottom sheets, hospital tuck, flannel rag across the pillow. Why I tend the elderly, for pay. What her sheets looked like, patches on patches on patches showing through holes. Why I tend the elderly, pure fear. How she sleeps in that bed, 87 and hunched, in husband's worn pajama tops. Why I tend the elderly. So someone will love me when I am old. What I tell you in bed. Nothing. Only my legs talk to yours. They beg.
Penelope Scambly Shot. Reading from Baiting the Void, and before Penelope, this set, Judith H. Montgomery reading from Red Jess. I want to thank both of you, and look for these books. There are other poems that I really wish that each of you could have read tonight. So they're just a wealth of really fine poems. This is Barbara Lamorticella. And on our next program, next week, Walt Curtis, my inimitable co-host, will be sitting right here in this chair at 10 p.m. And he invites listeners to call in. So tune in and hear his guest also. And 2 weeks from now, I'll be back, and my guests will be poets Jim Grable and Lex Runciman. So I have a very quick announcement here. Two of them. In Staten, on Sunday, June 11th, Eric Muller, Peter and Sandy Jensen, Lois Rosen, Ralph Salisbury, and Ingrid Wendt, and Sharon Wood Wortman will be getting together to give a reading in honor of the poet Dave Johnson, who was a journalist for many years with the Asian Reporter and well known to many in the poetry community, and passed away very untimely. They're going to be reading poems by and for Dave Johnson, and that's at the Staten second series of poetry readings free, and all admissions donations that people make will be sent to the Asian Reporter Foundation of the St. John's Library as remembrances of David Johnson. And that's from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Bird and Hat Inn in Staten. And audience members will be invited to stand up and read one or two poems dedicated to Dave or for other poets who you want to remember. And the other thing, June 12th, next Monday night, at Borders Books, at 7 o'clock, we will have Paul Ann Peterson with her most recent book, Jay Thiemeyer, who is a KABU commentator, a reviewer, and has a book called Marginal Notes, and has a very unique story and unusual history, having spent many years homeless. And he's a fine poet and writer, Jay Thiemeyer, and also Tiffany Brown. So stay tuned for the next wonderful offering on our community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.